that's
well, it's lovely to be here at Reading in Cork, and I'm delighted to have this opportunity, and I want to thank Paul and Vale for inviting me here to read from my first collection of poems, Calling the Tune, and one or two more recent poems. The first poem I'd like to read tonight is called The Centre of Excellence, and I've chosen it because of its relevance to what's happening in the health service today. It's called The Centre of Excellence. This is the centre of excellence. This is the woman Tess who died in the centre of excellence. This is the time of the woman Tess who died in a place of excellence. This is the watch that tells the time of the mother Tess who died in the home of excellence. This is the nurse wearing the watch that tells the time of the lover Tess who died in a blaze of excellence. These are the trolleys with patients on board, docked by the nurse wearing the watch that tells the time of courageous Tess who died in the fight for excellence. These are the stars on the walls of the ward, the moon, the marks, the microbes on board, described by the nurse wearing the watch that tells the time of the youthful Tess who died in an hour of excellence. This is the monk in a grubby gown who shuffles the length of the half-built ward, past the trolleys with patients on board, called by the nurse, checking the watch that tells the time of the teacher Tess, who died to an encore of this is the world of a paper clown. This is the monk in a blood-stained gown who swishes the length of the half-built ward, past the trolleys, microbes on board, to the worn-out nurse that winds the watch that ticks the time of the vibrant Tess who died in a wave of excellence. These are the gaffes, the stomachs and nose, removed in the name of a bankrupt clown who dandles a monk in a grubby gown, the length and breadth of a half-built ward, for years of promise on a notice board, and the overworked nurse that shakes the watch that tells the time of the woman Tess who died in a pool of excellence. These are the men in suits that know the blunders, the breasts, stomachs and nose removed in the name of a paper clown. This is the monk in a blood-stained gown who hurtles down a filthy ward, past the trolleys, coffins and board, to the hurried nurse who taps a watch that tells the time departed Tess who died in the life of excellence. This is the court where rests the ball. These are the men in suits that know the blunders, the breasts, stomachs and nose removed in the name of a paper clown. This is the monk in a grubby gown who stumbles down the half-built ward, past the trolleys, coffins and board, to the wasted nurse who taps a watch that tells the time of the woman Tess who died at the altar. Thank you. My next few poems belong to that category that loosely can be called love. Mm-hmm. Letting go. He's very wise, my man. He doesn't try to build on sand, nor does he get upset when rain is wet or the sun hot for what, as he says himself, is the point. What I'd like to know is, how do you become wise? How do you learn to let go? He lets go. Being wise, he knows, no one ever goes away. Even when you die, he says, warming to the subject now, you reappear in time as molecules in the air. Not too well upon molecules, but fascinated all the same, I say. In that case, if you died, couldn't I breathe you in? We'd really be together then, forever. Not very wise, he says. Just had our relationship laminated, and it looks quite well. I held off for a while in case we might work on it some more, but then I thought, what the hell? Leave it. It's done. Fixed forever. We'll never work on it again. I have it hung in the front room. I have it hung in the front room, crisp and fresh as memory, exuding dynamism and light. We stopped in the nick of time before laziness or complacency set in. I'd have hated it if the laziness or complacency had crept in. But strangely, now it's finished, I noticed flaws. They were barely visible at first. But when you look hard enough, as I do, since I have the space, they leap right out at you. The balance of give and take is definitely wrong. I see the whole thing now in a different light and can't help but wonder why I worked on this relationship so long. I see you got your copy into the exhibition. Well done. But I'd like to raise one niggly point. Did you really have to ever clean it out? I've lifted Van. You can sing now. Go on, sing. I've just given the birds permission to sing. They were singing already, the bastards. They don't know a thing about grief. The trees are allowed to breathe, although they were breathing anyway. That's the way it is with trees. I've lifted the ban on dragonfly swearing. The wind is whispering, and we are kissing again. My next poem. Of eating cake, creatively. Put away all knives, forks, and spoons. Anything that might confuse a cookie canted treat. Today we learn to eat for pleasure. Relax. Blank out extraneous thoughts from your mind and focus on cake. Please, don't stick your finger in for a quick taste, confectionery all over the place, and minimal enjoyment. What you do is, ease the cherry off of your teeth. Roll it around in your tongue. Savor its sweetness, its smoothness, its flavor. Now, bite, chew, and swallow. Next, dip your pinky in the curly rosette. Twirl and lick and continue like this till the cream is gone. Relax again. You warmed up so we can speed up and knit. Knit all the bits around the edge till they're gone, till you're left with cake unadorned. Now it's time to let go of inhibitions and all the blocks we're heir to. Let the hair down, take the cake in both hands and eat, eat. Don't mind the chocolate on your face. Don't mind the cream that's up your nose. Don't mind those slappy, slappy sounds, but those are happy, happy sounds. Enjoy. 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 You are allowed to finger up the remaining crumbs. There's satisfaction in remaining crumbs. Oh, pleasure. But time's up. That's all on cake. Next week, oysters. And tasty, compared. My next poem is called Time to Go. All parents feel nostalgic when their children are about to leave the nest, but they also get very apprehensive if it looks like they might. Time to go. There you go, out the door, reference in hand. What can I say? I could tell you there's a danger you'll become a cog in a machine burning incense before the God of Profit. I could tell you if you play your cards right, you'll reach the top by 45, join a team with management, where burnout rates a compliment and heart attack a guarantee. But you have your eye on the ball, money in the bank, a nice flat, women. I could tell you the Dow Jones is a bubble and Wall Street's in trouble, that Soros the snitch could initiate a crash with potential to ruin this window of opportunity for you, but you would merely shake your head. How sad it is to be middle-aged and out of touch. So all I say is, son, it's time to go. Time to get a life. And the truth is, I have to attend to mine. The next two poems that I'll read, I've chosen them in the wake of the Ryan report. First one is called Shrouding Crime. The bishop in his palace shredding implicating files, Monsignor on prime time shrouding crime in canon law. The Pontiff in St. Peter's sheathing death and papal bull. We truly regret. Too late for that, the shout from the back and damages knocking on the door. This next poem is called A December Rain, and I wrote this after Father Brendan Smith. Brendan Smith was the priest who brought down a government over 15 years ago now, when it was discovered that a file on his abuse of children was left gathering dust in the Attorney General's office when it should have been acted on as a matter of urgency. It's called December Rain. This is the Sistina. December rain breaks the cold snap. Outside a black-backed gull screeches out its useless warning. Father moves from chair to chair, waiting for his visitor, a child, who earlier has been given the nod, the familiar sign, the sound of tapping on an outhouse roof splashing, the rain trickling down the window pane like tears. The boy enters the room, fighting back tears. He fears the onslaught of the billowing black storm clouds gathering, knows the flashing light will take no hostages. The Reverend Father gestures for him to kneel, to first make the sign of the cross. The day drags its heels as the child blocks everything out. In year one, a child of God was born, brought into this veil of tears. His mother a virgin, his father a dove, a sign of peace on earth, of love. But still, black thoughts of murder intrude, hatred for the Father, who stands naked before Jesus, blushing. After the word, the deed, a thousand needles flashing pain, resistance of no avail, a fragile child, no match for a man built like a tank, the Reverend Father, smelling up chips, face, oozing oil, sweating tears of ecstasy that flow like a river into a yawning black well, a howling wail like the howling wind. A sign of the times that can do as they like, or a sign of malaise. The river becomes a flood, flashing, and the boy discovers black, everything black, walls, ceiling, a thunderclap. He paints a child nailed to the cross, body black with blood-like tears that drip onto his shield in the name of the Father. destined to bring the sins back to the Father. For when the time comes, the boy will sign, point the finger, there will be an end to tears. He will hear the chimes of freedom flashing, and the collar will reappear, stripped as the child was, covering tracks, whitewashing black. In the black December of the soul, the child makes a sign that becomes a beacon flashing, drawing tears that are after flow from the Father. The next piece I'll read is a prose poem. This isn't in the collection, but it will be in the next. It's called Once I Was a Child. Once I was a child, and I believed in God, scavengers, fairies, and bogeymen. It was 1954, the Marian year, and everyone in Ireland believed in God and scavengers. There were processions, thousands of them, the length and breadth of the country. There was knock, and there was magic. It was the Marian year, and I believed my Harris mother when she told me a birth cert was a piece of paper with your name, age, and address written on it. So I wrote my own birth cert to satisfy Sister Celsus, who insisted there could be no communion without a cert, and there would be no going on to second class if you hadn't made it your first. Frank Sinatra vetted it up first. You can't have one without the other. He wasn't singing about the Irish church and state, of course, for Frank was an American and he didn't know a thing about Ireland. Anyway, in I marched and handed Sister Celsus my certificate as she stood talking to Sister Aloysius. Well, they laughed and laughed and laughed. Children were a great source of entertainment in Lucy. I still believed in God after I made my communion, although I did have doubts. If God is so good, I reasoned, why is there evil in the world? But this was pre-Vatican II, and if it wasn't in the Penny Catechism, you didn't ask. I gave up asking questions afterwards. I discovered failure when I was 7, and they asked me to sing Adeste Fideles. It was Christmas, and money was short, and families had to make their own entertainment. De Valera had great time for church and families. Everyone knew he was doing his best for families, for the whole country in fact, but what with industry stagnating, a balance of payments deficit and all the rest of it, well, things weren't going so well. The whole Comely Maidens Dancing at the Crossroads thing hadn't worked out either, for all the youth were emigrating to Britain. Anyway, I sang like a nightingale, and they laughed till they cried. Children were a great source of entertainment in those days. I gave up singing afterwards. I gave up believing in fairies and bogeymen around the same time, but this being Ireland, God took longer. I discovered love when I was 8. Mum, why are you crying? I asked. Because I'm going to die, the old woman sighed, driven to distraction, childminding, her husband working beyond in Scotland, her daughter, mother of 12, age 30, up in Vincent's, having her veins done. Don't cry, Gran, I said. I love you, Gran. Don't die. I won't die, and she said, and dried her eyes. I discovered treachery when I was 9. These were the Whitaker years, when Dad was told he'd have to give up his economic dream. You'll have to give up that dream, Eamon, Ken warned. Open up to multinationals, otherwise it's down the tubes. Did you know your gran is going to die? The aunt asked slyly, not caring a hoot about the economy. As eyes narrowed, they watched and waited for the tears to flow, which they did, out of a sad, empty well. Children were a great source of entertainment in those days. I discovered sex when I was 10. I lived in 8, but then this was Ireland. Not the real thing, just a few bare facts from a medical book. I was only doing a bit of research, of course, for it was a well-known fact there was no sex in Ireland before television. Except we found out later there was sex in Ireland before television, lots and lots of it up and down the country, in orphanages, reformatories, vestries, convents, no end of it. But it was all very discreet. I certainly didn't know a thing about it at the time. But as I said, children were a great source of entertainment in those days. A lot of them gave up sex afterwards. 1960 and the world economy was booming. Welfare meant better standards for all, and everyone was challenging the system and received wisdom. But that was abroad and in America. Things weren't moving quite so fast in Ireland, where we were still managing to hold on to traditional values, censorship, sexual repression, that sort of thing. In any case, I was developing my own brand of wisdom. By 1966, the year the IRA blew up Nelson's Pillar, I had a map for life under my belt that didn't include involvement in things that were none of my business, such as the North, feminism, civil rights, or student protests. And since marriage had to be achieved somewhere between age 20 and 26, I kept my eye on the ball. After the nuptials were signed, I threw away my map and followed my man's, which prescribed unusual hobbies like DIY, restoration of antiques, and building walls. I did my best. But boredom and ennui set in, and eventually I found I couldn't follow his map at all. I got lost. Everyone agreed I lacked a plan. When I found myself again, I was no longer a child, and I knew there was no God, no map, no plan. I began writing my own plan. These developments brought their own problems, of course. It was 1986, and from the pulpit, the bishops had just won a victory against the introduction of divorce into Ireland. The church was still hankering after the days when men were men, women were women, and children were a great source of entertainment. Once I was a child, and I believed in gods, scapulars, fairies, and bogeymen. Now I am a woman, and I don't believe in any of these things anymore. The last poem I'd like to read is called The Music Never Stopped, and I was delighted to have this shortlisted for the Gregory O'Donoghue Award there recently. This is a 15. The music never stopped. It's 21 long weeks since her lover packed up his battered feelings and left her space to mull, make sense of the music that hums and tings and thrums in this town, the city of tribes he once saw as home, a dream that foundered. But still his face in the mirrored glass that fronts the face out to the river, the walkway for lovers. She imagines him back building a home by a meadowsweet country field not left, adrift alone in a house in town, afraid to tune in, to listen to music. He once performed so happily music beyond the point of rescue they traced on their hearts, notating a trip to town, a gift, a grace for autumn lovers, pausing to sign at a stall on the left, laughing and talking the whole way home. He used to say where true love lay was home, but the tone deaf do not hear the music until it's too late, until all that's left is the forest flame planted to face the south, the sun, the sigh of a lover trying to please his prima donna from town. The affair in the end wore him down. He shut up shop altogether, now roams the world alone looking for a lover who will make him whole. But the music he hears is the old song, a mellow case of the wine he longs for, the sound he left. And while he searches both right and left, she waits in the house not far from town, looks in the mirror and sees there a face, aging and lifting an image of home. But still the ache, the sound of music that never fades, the song of her lover, who left, packed up his feelings, a lover, bound to another harmonic in music, face turned forever to
school, college, home.